Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everybody. My name is Sonia Dirks. I'm a reporter with KQED. And welcome to our panel today. And I'm pulling the mic forward. I should know, being on the radio, I should know how to use the mic. So I'm highly disappointing. This is Hidden Stories, Three Fiction Writers on Telling the Truth. And I want to introduce to you our very distinguished, amazing, and talented panel today. And I'm going to try to get everybody's names right. Directly to my left is Vanessa Waugh, an award-winning journalist and writer. Her short story collection, Deceit and Other Possibilities, was called by Oprah's Magazine, which is a big deal in the literary world, a searing debut. And you might know her from her amazing columns in the San Francisco Chronicle, which always illuminate life in the Bay Area in a really amazing way for me. Then we have Shanti Sekran, who wrote Lucky Boy. She's been called a master of drawing. A little closer, see? Put off? Yeah. I was getting hot mic at that point.
Well, we might do it if it's okay.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
No.
Just pass it along when you're done.
I am much more comfortable doing this. There we go. She's been called a master of drawing detailed, richly layered characters and relationships. And her novel, Lucky Boy, has been called a story about immigration, privilege, and parenthood, and shows how we are connected and how we are, perhaps, irreparably divided, which I think is a very important story in times that we are in. And finally, I have Esme Wejun. Is that right? Did I get it right? Okay, Wong. Very sensitive about names, whose book, The Border of Paradise, has gotten rave reviews, including being called a best book of 2016 by NPR, which, of course, I have to note. Granta Magazine named her one of the best of young American novelists. And so, there we go, our panel today. I wanted to start off by asking each of you guys something a little deeper introduction about yourself. And so, from wild Googling, I have some questions for all of you. Esme, I read that your father there was a popular Taiwanese miniseries created about your dad's family. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that and how that influenced kind of storytelling in your life.
That was a really fascinating period in my family's life. So first there was the period when the people producing the miniseries were interviewing everybody in my family, and that took a number of years. But then when the series was actually coming out, all of these skeletons in the closet of my family were like pouring out of the closet, and I was learning new things every day, in part because at family dinners, you know, there'd be people crying because that day's episode had portrayed them in a particularly bad, poor light. And there were also these message boards, these Chinese message boards on which people would post like, so-and-so is such a, you know, bad word, nasty word. I don't know how much we're allowed to cuss here. So it was a very intense way to look at how telling the truth about a family can impact the family itself.
And then, Shanti, I want to ask you about growing up as the daughter of a mother who was a doctor, whose many of her patients were immigrants and undocumented immigrants.
Mm-hmm. So actually, just to full disclosure, I don't actually know whether they're undocumented or not. I imagine there is a combination of situations. Yes, my mom was a pediatrician, and for some reason, like, she never put me in like after school programs or anything. I was just always in her office after school for like hours. And often they would put me to work, and I'd be like doing the filing and, you know, when we had like actual file folders for our files. And I learned, you know, at a very early age, I was learning names, you know, and I think that's a very important entry point to start being aware of the different faces and the different histories of people around you. Just like the diversity of names was one of the first things that experience introduced me to. So yeah, it was an early education.
And then Vanessa, my question is a little more about your column because I love it so much.
Oh, thank you.
How do you think writing a column that sort of is so observational about life impacts you as a writer who's talking about, in some ways, truth and lies and secrets? Because in some ways, every week you kind of set out to tell us the truth of life. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think through observation, you pick out the specifics of a situation, and then you realize how just more complicated people and situations are the more closely you observe them. And so that's, it's so easy. We live in a time where we assume so much and think we know so much about other people or other sides, but really it's when you get at the specifics of someone's heart and their dreams that I think I hope I can convey that in my column or in my stories, so that you may not still agree with their decisions, but you understand what brought them there more than just dismissing them outright.
That's something that I think binds a lot of your work together, is stories about truth and this idea of within these stories there being a hidden truth, within these fictions there being a hidden truth. And so I wanted to ask you both, or all of you guys, to talk about the way in which your books address the kind of the topic at hand today, which is the nature of getting at truth through fiction. And I guess, Esme, I'll ask you to start down there at the end.
I think that the idea of getting at truth in fiction, there's so many levels to that question. But something that comes to mind when I think about my book, The Border of Paradise, is the idea of what is hidden when people behave badly or behave in a way that comes with serious consequences. Because one way I used to describe my book when I had to describe my book was that it was a book about people who do things out of love and do things with the best of intentions, but end up completely screwing up their lives and other people's lives in the process. And I just find that to be a real truth in the way that people often live their lives. There are all kinds of motivations behind people's actions. And often, more often than not, in my opinion, they are done with the best of intentions, despite their consequences.
So with Lucky Boy, you know, one of the first sparks of this book was me hearing a story on NPR about a Guatemalan woman who was fighting for custody of her child. Her child was being adopted away from her because she was in a detention center. And I wanted to get to the truth of what was actually going on there. And I think because I'm a fiction writer, for me, truth is emotional truth. It's very personal truth. And that's where I began with this. I think there seems to be a small controversy in the policymaking community about looking at the real human stories behind policy. Some people say that clouds judgment. I personally feel that when you're looking at something like immigration policy, you have to look at the people that this policy affects. You have to look at their stories and their histories and their futures, because every statistic is connected to an individual person. So that's sort of the angle that I took with Lucky Boy.
So you may have you heard of that study that showed that readers of literary fiction have more empathy? So give yourselves a pat on the back. But I do think that there is something to it, that if you can really deeply get yourself in someone else's shoes, and in their head, then you can, you know, you begin to consider other views, other than your own. I mean, I think about the books that I read even as a kid and how that opened up, connected me to people that didn't share my face or place, but, you know, I could find a way to relate. And so this whole idea of fiction, though, in this country, I've read that actually nonfiction books far outsell fiction. And someone asked me, well, why would you ever write fiction then? And I still believe that sometimes nonfiction, people may resist it. They're like, oh, I don't want to read about gun control, or I don't want to read about implicit bias. But if they're presented a novel, maybe as they're sitting poolside or on the airplane, you can kind of bring them closer to this point of view in a way that's maybe not as, bald or direct with nonfiction.
Because you enter into someone's experiences and their heart and their brain.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that so many times stories that I tell that are fact stories can often come from experiences I've had reading fictional books. I wanted to ask a little bit about something that I played out in some ways in your books, and that was, and Shanti, this question is a little bit for you, about the myth of the model minority and the way in which you played with that trope, really in a fascinating way in your storytelling. And I can, all the mics.
Yes, spoiled for choice.
So yes, the myth of the model minority, you know, this is the idea that the members of certain minority cultures, especially in this country, Asians and South Asians, they do what they're supposed to do, you know, in terms of being educated and taking a certain career track and being model citizens and keeping our heads down as well and staying quiet and not complaining, because we generally have a pretty comfortable life here statistically. with my book, I have an Indian American couple in my book, and they live in Berkeley, and they have one of these classically beautiful Berkeley lives. They go to the farmer's market, they eat at the cheese board, they get head massages now and then when they remember to, and they have that. They have that luxury. But my character, Kavya, has really had to fight to take her own path. So she's not a doctor, she's not an engineer, she's a chef at a sorority, because she's always loved being a chef. She loves cooking, she loves food, she's interested in it, and that's what she's wanted to do. She's struggling to conceive, and so she decides to foster a child and eventually adopt. And this, again, is not part of the model, you know, that her parents would have set out for her. So she's fighting against that, too. And so she's in a constant pursuit of individuality, which really is a very American concept. If you look at individuality, individualism versus collectivism, you know, that's one of these classically American concepts that we always go back to. So in a way, she's asserting her Americanness.
Our own individuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with my book, I used to joke with people like, oh, what's it about? And I'd say, model minorities behaving badly. So to this point about the model minority, like, there's a story that's inspired by real events about a Stanford imposter. I don't know if any of you remember her. This was back in 2007. Korean-American, had told everyone she'd gotten in, told her parents she got a scholarship from the ROTC, went off to college, said, oh, there's a mix-up in housing, ended up crashing with someone who took her in. She went to classes, attended study groups, took tests. In the spring, it was discovered she was, in fact, had not gotten in. Yeah. And I began to notice other examples. There was a case at UC Irvine. An Indian-American student had told his parents he was in med school. He was not. Come graduation, he marched on stage with a robe he had rented until another classmate said, this guy's not enrolled. So, you know, they booted him off. At UC Riverside, there was a guy who called in a bomb threat to try and halt graduation because, again, he had also failed out. But he got caught because he was standing nearby the bomb to make sure it got, you know, noticed. The point with that particular story from my collection wasn't that all Asian Americans are bound to, fake their way into college. But I really wanted to get inside, again, characters who could be sort of dismissed as crazy or just one note, and really understand what drove them to that decision.
Can I say something too? Yeah. So this idea of the model minority in literature, I feel, also extends to readers. A couple of days ago, did a Q&A with a book club over Skype. And I was asked about a circumstance in my book, which is, long story short, there is a Taiwanese immigrant who comes to the United States in mid-century America, and she decides to raise her children in this kind of outmoded Chinese tradition called Tongyangxi, in which the children are raised as brother and sister, but also to be married. And so the person who was reading the book as part of this book club said to me, I was really hoping throughout reading this book that that wasn't going to happen, because I didn't want the minority character in the book to be represented in this negative way. And I thought that was really interesting that the reader of that reader had been concerned about how I was portraying, Taiwanese people. And it was a concern that I had before the book came out. I reached out to a fellow writer who is also Chinese American and told her, hey, this book includes this outmoded tradition. It is really warped in the book, but I'm worrying that I'm doing a bad job as a Taiwanese American person to be introducing this idea as something in my novel. So that is a concern as well in readership.
Of the pressures from all sides, both from your readers and then, in your characters, from their parents, on themselves, and then from society, and then an extra burden about, especially in times where being different, being other, where being an immigrant is such a tainted thing. You do want to preserve and protect the kind of good stories, but then how do you tell the truth about messy, complicated humans?
Yeah, just to add one more thought, it's interesting you bring that up, because I think often you might think, oh, well, there's not so many representations, not so many books, and so is this the only thing that someone will take away for thinking about this community? But again, I think it just goes back to the specifics. This is the dynamic that's in your characters and not the entire community, so...
Which is why it's so important to have a diversity of voices and to have, tons of authors of, different ethnicities representing their stories, so that we can have the messy stuff, so that nobody feels this undue burden of representing the shiniest face of their community, to be consumed, because they're not the only voice.
Absolutely. Esme, I wanted to ask you about your bad poker face. And how that has helped you to tell the truth, and how that has impacted your writing and your ability to tell the truth in this really naked way in a really powerful novel.
Yeah, so to kind of speak a little bit about this bad poker face, I just have a bad poker face. Once I was playing Texas Hold'em with my family, and I got a four of a kind, and I looked at it, and I was like, ah! And then just like, and that was kind of the end of that. I mean, I maybe could have done really well. Anyway, in life, I tend to not be able to conceal my feelings. This is also something that extends to my fiction and my nonfiction. There's this kind of brazen honesty that I'm known for, but in a lot of ways it's because I don't know how else to live my life and how else to write. For example, in fiction, I was really interested in conveying different psychological states that I don't necessarily see in fiction. So I live with schizoaffective disorder, which is a mix of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. This means that I've experienced psychotic hallucinations. And so in this book, I wanted to depict what it's like to experience a psychotic hallucination in a way that I hadn't seen in other books before. And so there is a scene where that happens. So just kind of walking the reader through that in a way that I hadn't seen before in a nuanced and interesting way was something that I really cared about. And in my nonfiction, in a similar way, I write a lot about mental health issues, and in particular schizophrenia. My next book is a collection of essays about schizophrenia. And so in there is also a kind of brazen honesty because of my bad poker face in life and literature.
I love the idea of the bad poker face.
I think it's such a gift to not have a good poker face as a writer. What we want as writers is to get this thing that's sort of brewing in our chest, in our stomach, in our throat, and get that on the page. And so often the difficulty is in the translation of what you're feeling, that wordless feeling you have, and getting the words down on the page. So, yeah, you're lucky.
Yeah, I think as writers, it's not only what comes from within, but also sometimes we're like tuning forks, right? We're kind of more attuned to the electrical charge in other people, and that's what we find ourselves writing about as well.
Now, how do I have all the mics? Yeah. So going back to this idea that you guys were talking about in terms of the burden of representation, how do you, when you guys sit down to write these books, and very much writing as Asian women who are translating all of these complicated, messy things, as we said before, how do you navigate through that, through kind of getting at truth, but also handling these representational qualms, I guess? And this is for anyone, but Vanessa, I'm going to start with you.
Okay. I actually don't think about the reader until much later, because if there's enough voices in my head already. So I think, I mean, I took a writing workshop with Juno Diaz, and he said, you have to write for your 6 closest friends and a million other people. Meaning, write for your ideal, when it gets to the point when you actually even thinking about readers, like, picture them. But if you're successful enough, it will go across the universe, you know? So
I feel like the best representation, you know, the sort of model ideal representation of any character is the least interesting. What we want as writers and as readers is that messiness, that those contradictions, those less than admirable qualities. And so I think when you're building a character, no matter what, you know, you have to get to that dark, messy stuff. Otherwise, you just end up with sort of a stick figure, you know, in your diorama box that you create.
Yeah, and I just want to add to that last point. In getting to the messy stuff and depicting the messy stuff, I found it's also really important to kind of at least gesture at, if not get very deep into why any given person, regardless of ethnicity or race, is doing what they're doing. There was a time in the life of this book where the Taiwanese character seemed incredibly cruel for no particular reason and was almost this kind of like demonic mother figure. And it wasn't until I went backwards and started writing up to that point, like, how did she get to this point and what is happening with her in these moments, that the book really kind of gained traction and a depth that wasn't there before. So
knowing someone's story can do so much to make you understand how they get to where they are. So we've heard a little bit about your guys' work, and now I want to ask you to read, because I want to hear some of this amazing stuff and the way you're tackling it and the actual product that you guys sort of labored and sweated over and created. So you, Esme, you have the mic, so I'm going to start down there, but if you would give us a sample.
So I was going to read one certain part, but now I'm going to read a different part. So this is from a chapter called Wife of David, and Jia Hui is the narrator in translation. In Mandarin, the words for suicide are 自杀. In literal terms, this means self-kill. My husband David has self-killed, and it has been 4 months now. I knew this would happen once I found him crashed to the floor from attempting to hang himself. I knew that it was only a matter of time. Or yes, I knew this when I was first told that he was crazy by his own mother. But who can believe one's mother-in-law, especially when that mother-in-law refers to you as a souvenir without batting an eyelash and burns with anger in your presence simply because you exist and have small eyes and skin with the undertone of ripe star fruit? Or yes, I knew that he would zizza while in a penthouse suite in San Francisco when we were surrounded by luxury and William was in my belly and I awoke to be confronted with a floor of broken glass. I'm afraid to admit that I was ever so naive. What other things do I not know when I thought I knew so much? David was the one who changed my name. It was Jiahui Chen until I was 19, and who I was then bears little resemblance to who I am now at 33, with 2 children and a dead husband who behaved as though we had always lived in this wooden home in these woods, in this former gold mining town, like an inserted memory. I am much older, for example, than the Daisy Nowak who walked into Saks Fifth Avenue in the summer of 1954. In the air-conditioned building scented with perfume, I stood next to my new white husband, who was willing to spend $2,000 or more on his wife, whom he called an oriental lamb not only to my ear and passionate love, but to anyone willing to indulge him in listening. David, who only knew of money and not of pretty clothes, and I not knowing the ridiculousness of what 2,000 American dollars meant or the extent of David's irrationality or wealth. But I looked at the sales girl, whose hair was a helmet of distinct red curls, each a perfect sculpture, and I read in her round face the answer as the corners of her mouth pulled back and her eyes shot the accusation, "Who do you think you are?" I emerged from the multi-mirror dressing room in the first dress, which exposed the soft hollow above my collarbones and fit at the waist with a full skirt. I felt the flutter that I had known when, at the bar, David first put his scarred hand on my waist, when I felt it through the silk of my dress. Fatty asked me later if the scarred hand was worse than the white men's thicketed arms and legs. Was it worse than their pale, coy bellies, she wanted to know. The sight of myself in the multiple mirrors, dressed like a Hollywood starlet out of a song and dance magazine, was like seeing a chicken with the head of a lizard. I could never become the girl that the dress was made for, but I would be an entirely new creature. I smiled. The black-haired girl in the mirror smiled. Blonde David grinned like a child. You think that these details are not important, but they are. In Kaohsiung, as the daughter of a mama-san, I could have had the red-haired woman's face kicked in by thugs. But as Daisy Nowak, wife of David, I could only smile.
Okay, so one of my main characters, Soli, is a young woman from Mexico, and she's undocumented. We follow her from her hometown in Oaxaca up through the border, and then she ends up in Berkeley. So I'm going to read a bit of this Berkeley section. She gets a job working for a family, sort of housekeeping for them. This is her first day. The next morning, Soli got off the bus at a corner of the city canopied by oaks. People streamed by in pairs and trios. Soon, Soli would know this corner well. She would know it was Shattuck and Vine, that in one direction lay the university, in another the water, and behind her the hills. Around her spread the gourmet ghetto. Let's make one thing clear. Soli had seen ghettos. This was no ghetto. All she saw were women pushing their babies in strollers, a few fathers who looked like movie stars, the young on bicycles and the old in sun hats, seated at cafe tables. The salty warmth of baking bread drifted over the rooftops to nuzzle her, like a cat on her shoulder, the moment she stepped off the bus. In Popocalco, the young men had left. The town rattled with their absence, and only the newly built houses gave evidence that they still existed somewhere in the world. But Soli remembered them, and the roads stretching empty remembered them too. In Berkeley, there were people everywhere. Students finished their degrees and dragged their feet. People left their high-paying careers and retired here. Streaming in constantly were the academics and vagrants of the world, with their doctorates and dogs on strings. Buying bungalows and hybrid cars were the young families who had good jobs and helpful parents and custom-built child-carrying bicycles. They all stayed and lived and took up room. They pulsed down the sidewalks and pushed into lanes of traffic. They stood in line at bakeries and pizzerias and surged through outdoor farmers' markets as if fresh herbs and homemade kombucha were all that could matter in the world. She was learning that in Berkeley, even beautiful things were small. From the street, the Cassidy house was nowhere to be seen. It hid somewhere in a tumble of vines and crimson trumpet blossoms. She fought through the brush until she reached the front door, crossed herself, and kissed her thumb. Somewhere in that lovely mess of vines, she found a doorbell, which she rang. A rush of toenails on the floor, sharp barking, someone scolding a dog. The door opened, and before her stood Toto, the elephantine dog, a lady, and a little girl. The woman, struggling to grab the dog by the collar, was tall with red hair. From where she stood, Soli could smell the coffee on her breath and the sweet waft of a blossom that she recognized but could not name. The woman caught hold of the dog and dragged him into the house, calling, "Come in," and shut the door.
The little girl's name could not be pronounced. The mother said it easily enough, but it sat like a fuzz on Soli's tongue. The mother said it twice more and spelled it S-A-O-I-R-S-E, which didn't help. Soli worried for the little girl and her strange little name. It's Celtic, Mrs. Cassidy told her. Traditionally Irish. It's part of our heritage. We want her to be in touch with who she is, you know. In Popocalco, women had names their grandmothers had and their grandmothers before them. Only politicians spoke of heritage. She would call the little girl Mija. The Cassidys lived in a bungalow that smelled of green plants and wood. That first morning, it was plain to see that why they wanted her every day. This house would need a strict daily purge just to keep it from soiling itself. The bookshelves were piled with ceramic trinkets, things that seemed to be made by school children, but which, she found out later, were really quite expensive. The kitchen was more of a jungle than a kitchen, with plants that hung from the ceiling and pots of herbs crowding the windowsill above the sink. The sink was a work of art, a surrealist sculpture of balancing pots and chicken carcass. Dishes upon dishes upon dishes, a leaning tower of refuse. It smelled of old food and damp cloth. Soli's stomach lurched, and she feared she would be sick right there, that this house and the baby inside would not be getting along. From the kitchen, the signora led her to the master bedroom. Every day, she said. Every day, yes? Soli nodded. The signora pointed to the bed, the carpet, the dresser. Questo, she said. Questo y questo, ma no questo. She pointed to the closet. See? Soli followed her finger, piecing together what seemed to be a melange of Spanish and Italian, when the signora gave up and switched to English. I'm sorry about the mess, Soli. You can see why we needed you. Brett's been in Hong Kong for a month, and things are just getting completely wacky. I'm not a messy person. Soli smiled. But you can see there's a lot of work to do. So take your time. Help yourself to anything in the kitchen, okay? Mi casa es su casa. Or whatever. She scoffed at herself and left the room. Thank you, was all Soli could say. She sniffed a curtain and frowned. This was most certainly not her casa.
So, I'll be reading from a short story that's based, inspired by reporting both in San Francisco's Chinatown and in the Pearl River Delta, which is east of, or west of Hong Kong, and where many of the early immigrants to China came from, because it was on the southern coast, and it was also a place of famines, floods, and bandits. And they continue to have immigration from there. So the story is the older the ginger. Sometime after lunch, old Wu realized he'd been kidnapped. On the way from the airport, his cousin had taken a detour. If he'd driven in circles or gone the wrong direction, old Wu wouldn't have known the difference. More than a half century ago, he left the hills green with pine and bamboo for San Francisco and hadn't returned since. Less than an hour into the drive, his cousin parked in front of a restaurant. They were the only customers at the only table, and the only staff, his cousin's daughter, Little Treasure. She hovered, simpering and smiling like a courtesan. It was startling to find himself in high demand after his years among the bachelors of Chinatown. Finding a wife had been a competitive endeavor, and old Wu hadn't much to differentiate himself as a suitor, just another waiter turned cook. Then his mother had written, insisting old Wu marry. She was 93, he was 76. Come back, she told him. Come back and find a wife. Little Treasure dropped off toothpicks and a bowl of lychees and poured another cup of tea, but he refrained from drinking. He had a long ride ahead to the village, and his leaky bladder didn't need more pressure, and the strong brew made him jittery. A few minutes ago, his cousin had excused himself to urinate, and old Wu should too, but when he tried to turn the handle of the restaurant's front door, it didn't budge. It must be stuck, the wooden frame warped and swollen. Hey, hey, he shouted. Little Treasure tugged on his elbow. Uncle, eat. She looked at him coyly from beneath her lashes. Does it taste like how you remember? We filled ours with air, he said. during his childhood, his family ate meat only once a year during the Spring Festival, but this young girl had never known such want, only China on the rise and none of its turmoil. He knocked again and leaned his weight against the door. Locked. He searched for another exit, but didn't see another door, and the sole window was too small to squeeze through. He'd heard of brides abducted by grooms, but never a kidnapped groom. His cousin must want to present his daughter to Old Wu to make her the first and most memorable candidate for marriage, and the green card that came along with the deal. In time, she could sponsor her parents, her siblings, their spouses, and their children to immigrate, a prize her father wouldn't let slip out of his fingers. Uncle, eat. Little Treasure had a broad, plain face, placid as a cow, her beauty residing in the cascade of inky black hair that fell to her waist. In a tight t-shirt and flared jeans, she was as tall as him and twice as strong, with the muscular arms of a model revolutionary. She could level weeds and enemies alike. She could pin him to the narrow bed that he now noticed beneath a calendar of beer models. Uncle, he'll be back soon. Sit, sit. You've had a long flight. He settled into his chair. Even if he escaped, he didn't know where he was or how far he'd have to walk to his village. Soon enough, his cousin would understand that love at first sight hadn't transpired. Little Treasure would have to wait her turn to be ranked and compared to the other women whom the village elders had selected for his consideration. Her hand crept to his thigh, and he pushed it away. Let me help you, she whispered. Her face burned. He shuffled away, wondering if his cousin was spying through a crack, trying to catch Old Wu in an indelicate position. Little Treasure wept, burying her face into her hands. Young maiden, he began. Young? Her cheeks glittered with tears. You should see who they have picked out for you. Girls pried from their dolls. I'm a leftover woman. You don't want an old gingerroot like me, Old Wu said. The older the ginger, the hotter the spice, she said. When is he coming back, he asked. As long as it takes. He's staying out until for as long as it takes. You're my last chance. You're not old enough to be thinking about the end, he said. No one wants meat that's gone off. She pushed the bowl of lychees towards him, which he ate to cleanse his greasy mouth. Juicy and sweet, its flesh snowy white. He spit the shiny pit into his cup palm, and he had another, savoring the sweetness of sultry summer nights. His mother used to peel lychees for him, digging in her thumbnail to break the flesh. Old Wu had been his mother's firstborn and her favorite. And when he was very young, he followed her to the river where she beat laundry against the rock. How mighty she had seemed, warm mud squishing between his toes, sunshine heavy on his cheek, and the smell of the river, of wind on water and churned earth. Little Treasure cleared the table, and he smelled the dank musk of her, straw and loamy soil, and all at once he remembered his boyhood, the life he'd left behind, and he was overcome with longing for this lost world. He closed his eyes, inhaling.
Thank you guys so much. I feel like I just got to go through three wormholes. So one question I wanted to ask you, sort of getting back to the hidden stories aspect of this, is obviously we have heard much in the last year of living in the post-fact world, a world in which in places that were once reserved for truth, newspapers and journalism, the news, truth has sort of lost meaning. And in a way, you're writing fiction to get at truth in a time when nonfiction has unshackled itself from truth. And I wanted to ask, is fiction in some ways, in a post-fact world, a better way to find what's real?
Well, I guess it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that like people may resist nonfiction because they think it has an agenda or because they think it's fake. But I mean, we live in times that defy fiction, actually, that if it sounds like a cheesy thriller that we have Russians in the White House, like, if you tried to write a thriller based on the last 6 months of this country, people would be like, this is
not believable.
So in a way, I think you're bringing something up important that fiction that truly tries to get at these complexities maybe can get at truth in a way that reality can't bear. So.
I think of fiction as kind of a Pandora's box of the truth. Like if you take the truth and open it and just let everything out, that's what fiction is. It's a very deep and complex exploration of one fact or a smaller set of facts. And you know, I think we do live in a world where fact and fiction, they slide into each other. We don't really know, you know. We can't trust even those of us who trust the news. We've come, I think, a lot of us to a stage where we're constantly questioning what we're hearing, and that's not a bad thing. I think we need to have that sort of analytical eye on what we're hearing and seeing, no matter what the source is.
I have a friend who has a friend, and I, and yes, this is a very interesting story. So my friend has a friend, we'll call him W, and W does not believe in reading fiction, and I heard about W through my friend. Apparently W doesn't believe in reading fiction because W only reads nonfiction. Why? Because why would you spend time reading stuff that isn't true? And I remember being so mad at this person I'd never met in my life, not only because I spend a lot of my life writing fiction, but also because it seems so wrongheaded to me, in part because of all these things that we've been saying about the power of fiction and what fiction can do. I do think that fiction does get at truths in a way that nonfiction absolutely cannot. I know that personally, there are things that I want to write about that are very deep and true for me that I cannot get at in my nonfiction writing. Because I do both, I feel like there's an interesting way in which I kind of parse out what I will and will not write about in nonfiction versus fiction. There are, I think, ways that fiction can get at emotional truths, especially that nonfiction has a hard time getting at. Having to adhere to facts, I think, is also something that can constrict nonfiction in a way that fiction does not have to deal with.
I just want to add, though, it's interesting how fiction, often people, like the first question in Q&A is like, well, how much of it is true? And if you're writing nonfiction, people ask like, well, what did you sort of massage and change? How much isn't true? So...
Yeah, no, it's an interesting kind of world between these two in story, because you're doing storytelling in both, and you know, as a journalist and, you know, as a nonfiction writer. I wanted to ask one more question, and that was about the impact that news stories have, because you had said that it was an NPR story that kind of lit a spark in your head that then led to the novel. And I know the other of you guys are, you're a journalist, you write nonfiction. How does the things you encounter in the nonfiction world sort of seep into your fiction world?
So my with Lucky Boy, this was heavily, I mean, I had to really, really go deep with nonfiction, with research, to be able to write this story. Because there was so much I didn't know about immigration policy, about, you know, living in Mexico, about leaving Mexico. So I had to just structure this heavily on nonfiction. But I think it was that nonfiction framework that allowed me to go very deep emotionally with what was happening with these characters, because it was like, it's like scaffolding basically for a fictional work to have this, basis in reality. And so I used it in that way, and it gave me some freedom with creating my characters and going forward from there. Yeah.
Yeah, I see what you're saying about scaffolding, or for me, it's almost like the jumping off point or the spaces in between where the official record isn't going to reflect how people, what they're thinking or even what they're saying, especially if they're not going to talk about it. The Stanford imposter, for example, no one ever, she wasn't explaining why she did what she did. So that gave me license to write about it. The first story in my collection is based on there. I mean, it's still going on. There's this trend of Asian Americans, Chinese Americans born in the U.S. or Canada going back to Hong Kong or Singapore, Taiwan to find stardom because of the sort of obstacles they have.
I suggested I try and do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I know someone's sister was in a girl band or something in Taiwan. So my story, and then my story is based on this case of this guy, Edison, who, he went to get his computer laptop fixed, and which is always the start of your doom, right? And so even though he'd deleted the images, the text found it, basically of him getting in every sort of position with every starlet in Hong Kong. So he fled back to the U.S., where he was completely anonymous. And so my story isn't necessarily based on, you know, my character is my own, but I just was really intrigued by that. By that thing of being like Brad Pitt famous in one place and a complete nobody in your hometown. And I had originally reported on that story as a news story, like just the trend of people going over. So, it sort of fixed in my imagination. And then I returned to it in fiction. And I've heard from readers saying, like, is there more to his story? So, yes.
Yeah, from my perspective, the thing that leaps to mind for me most quickly is not so much a specific news story, but kind of this onslaught of news that happened after the election. I really felt like I was drowning in news, and all I could think of was, like, this is very, very stressful. But instead of writing like a think piece about, man, post-election America is really stressful, because I don't really think that's very interesting to anybody, I decided to write a short story about a character who is undergoing consultations for electroshock therapy at the same time that the election is happening. And so that story, What Terrible Thing It was just published in Granta. And it was a way for me to talk about nonfiction, like things that are happening, the election, the feelings that, you know, I was having during the day of the election, in a way that was fictional.
The bones of truth. So I want to open up this discussion to the audience and see if there are any questions from y'all for our writers.
Hi, and thank you for this very interesting panel. I wanted to explore this idea of truth a bit more, truth in fiction. And one of the things I believe truth itself is not very definitive. It's temporal, and it's also sort of, it's subjective. So isn't fiction more about examining what is truth at that moment? What is your opinion on this? Anyone?
Yeah, I mean, it is subjective. And so fiction is about looking at backstory and looking at, you know, the circumstances that lead up to a certain moment of truth for a character. And I guess the standard structure is you have a set of circumstances, they lead to a moment of truth, a moment of reckoning. Your character makes a decision of some sort, and then that leads the reader to a deeper understanding of the truth of that character and their future and their situation. So fiction is almost it's like a mining of the truth. It's an exploration of subjectivity and relativity.
Because the reader has a stake in what the reader is reading, there are all kinds of ways in which the quote-unquote truth can be malleable. I mean, I experienced this a lot with my this debut novel. I've had many interpretations presented to me by various readers. And in my opinion, and I think different writers have different feelings about this topic, but in my opinion, like, all of these interpretations are valid because they're what the reader has brought to the table. For me, like, I put it out in the world, and then it's up to the reader to, like, have their experience with it and interpret their truth with that story as they will.
So I don't write linearly. I write what interests me that day, and I'll have, like, an idea of a scene that I want to get done,
And if that's a scene that's speaking to me that day, I'll write it. And eventually it all kind of comes together. In terms of fiction carrying a certain load that nonfiction can't, with Lucky Boy, I have these scenes where my character is in a detention center, and one time that this came into play was when I had an opportunity to maybe get to speak to an ICE officer. And then, like, I had a connection that was going to try to connect me to sit down with an ICE officer and speak to them. And they just wouldn't play along, the ICE person. So I never got to speak to them. But, you know, the researcher in me was disappointed, but the fiction writer said, well, this is a good thing because now I can write, you know, I can write what I know from my research of detention centers without being burdened by the official line that is fed to me by the ICE officer. So sometimes, you know, getting to play with fiction can reveal truths, and it does free the writer. Yeah, so in case that didn't pick up, the question is about Berkeley, and because this novel is set in Berkeley, how my relationship with the city or my perception of the city of Berkeley may have changed. Well, I've always loved Berkeley. I grew up in Sacramento, and Berkeley was like the place to try to get to. And I went to school here, I went to university here, and I've lived here again for the past 7 years. So I know the city well. I think one of the new ways I started to look at it was in terms of who lives here and who's able to live here and how. With property prices, with the cost of living here, you know, we have a very diverse group of people out on the street. If you walk down the street in Berkeley, you know, it's an incredibly diverse place, both ethnically and socioeconomically. But when you actually go inside houses, you know, who's in those houses? That's what I started to think about as a departure from how I'd often always thought about Berkeley. You know, who gets to live here and send their kids to school here? What's that about?
So for me, as characters might be inspired by reporting I did, or just even a story that caught my eye, or conversations I had with friends where I thought, huh. But the thing is, in the end, the character becomes my own. When I've done presentations, some people ask, like, oh, does the girl from Stanford know you wrote about her? But I didn't write about her. She's my character. So there may be something she could recognize in the broad outlines, but she wasn't speaking. So it was, you know, I entered that space. And there's other stories in my book where they're directly inspired by things. You know, everyone's like, oh, which story is like most like you? And in a way they're all like me because they all came from my imagination and like what I was thinking and what compelled me. So in the end though, like this character as I develop the character, you know, they're no longer tied to, the circumstances that happened in real life, because there's an end point to that, and you have to really go deeper and go into them. That's when they become my own. So.
And now I think it's the moment of truth for us and this panel. But we do have book signings. You guys, all of your books are outside. They're going to be signing them. You should go. You should get them to sign your books, because then you can be like, look, I've got this book signed by this awesome person. The books are sold by East Wind Books of Berkeley, and it'll be happening right outside in the atrium. And thank you so much for your questions and for coming to listen to us today.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.